Hey, this is Russell, and I work at the video store, the place that we can go to every week when it's movie night. On days like today, when the store is quiet, I get to chat to my friends about the films and the series that we're loving. All right, let's do it. Let's open up the shop. Did you see that thing yesterday on the TV? How's it?
Morning.
Hi.
How you guys doing?
All right, dude.
I'm fine.
Are you strong? Cole, you don't seem strong.
I've had a bad night.
Had a bad night.
Yeah.
I'm sorry.
It's okay.
Welcome to the video store.
Yeah.
Thank you for wandering into our lovely video store. We've got ourselves a Graham GeForce Hackney.
Good morning.
Who is an editor and the producer of our podcast.
Yeah.
We've got ourselves a Cole Kolsky Matthews.
Hey.
Who is a digital copywriter.
Yeah, video copywriter.
Oh, video copywriter. Yeah. Okay, we're refining the name each time.
Yeah.
My name is Russell. I am the owner of The Bioscope, which is an independent cinema here in Johannesburg.
It's the best cinema in Johannesburg.
Aww, bless you. Bless you. And we get together once a week to work here at our lovely video store, and it's a lovely chance for all of us to hang out.
Mm.
We have lots to talk about.
Yeah.
I want to talk about The Phoenician Scheme.
Cool.
Which is the new Wes Anderson picture.
Lekker.
Which has graced the Bioscope screen. And we've had ourselves some sold out screenings this past weekend. And we're going to keep going.
Well done.
You guys haven't had a chance to see it yet.
No,
hey?
Not yet.
Sorry, I ghosted Graham on his invite to go watch it. I'm sorry.
Right.
Perrin saw it. So Perrin took the only copy.
Okay.
Here at the video store.
So bastard.
We'll see what Perrin thinks of that. But myself and Graham went to Karate Kid Legends last week.
Nice.
The new Karate Kid. Mm. We went to a media screening of that. So we would love to tell you about it, Cole, because it is delightful.
Yeah.
Oh, yeah.
But we always like to kick things off with a little, hey, did you guys see?
Let's do it.
Who's got a good one to start?
I can kick us off.
All right.
Let's do this one. Hey, did you guys see the trailer for Good Fortune?
No.
Okay,
no,
so this is a new Keanu Reeves movie.
Okay.
Keanu Reeves back in the world of comedy.
I was about to say, which Keanu?
This is comedy Keanu. He plays an angel.
Oh, I did see this trailer.
Okay, it looks kind of fun. He plays an angel who's trying to like level up and become like a better angel.
Okay.
So he's assigned to help someone out. That someone is Aziz Ansari, who's also writing and directing.
Oh no.
This movie.
Yeah.
Okay.
Which is interesting.
I'm not a fan of Master of None. Was that a show?
Oh, I loved season one and two.
I never saw it.
Yeah.
The third season was very pretentious and stupid.
I didn't even know it went for that long.
Yeah, yeah. Okay. No, but one and two I thought were masterclass.
Oh,
okay.
Really?
Yeah. You didn't dig Master.
It was the only reason I didn't like, the only thing to not like about Parks and Rec.
Tom Haverford.
Tom Haverford, yeah.
I thought he was amazing.
Yeah. Anyways.
Okay. Okay, Good Fortune.
Yeah. Seth Rogen as well, he's in it.
Okay.
Yeah. It looks amusing.
Do you think it'll be cinema or
I believe it's cinemas,
linked to a streamer?
I think it's cinemas.
All right, cool.
Yeah.
Look out for that. Kolsky?
Yeah. Hey, did you guys see that a Limpopo-based, I'm saying Limpopo-based because that's what they say, I'm assuming that means South African, filmmaker, won at Cannes?
Yes.
Won what? But that's very cool, but what?
Best African film. The filmmaker's name is Murena Emmanuel Netshitangani. Sorry, I tried. And the film is Lubunyu.
Lubunyu.
And it won Best African Film.
Okay, I didn't know there was a Best African Film award.
Yeah. But fuck, we have a Cannes winner in our country.
We've had a few before.
No, totally. But I'm this year.
Yeah.
A big mention and shout out is South African filmmaker Oliver Hermanus.
Yes.
Had a film in competition this year. Didn't win, but in the past has won some of the many other awards in Cannes.
Okay.
He won the Queer Palm when we went, which was in 2011.
Right.
For the film Skoon Hate, which is still like probably one of the best South African films I've ever seen. It was called Beauty in the Rest of the World. But that's very cool.
That's awesome. Yeah. We must see if we can chat to him.
Yeah, that could be amazing.
Yeah.
Hey, did you guys see Stranger Things has a very interesting release schedule?
Yes, I did see this.
For the fifth and final season of Stranger Things.
Yeah.
It's going to be epic with a whole bunch of almost cinematic episodes. Apparently, it's like 8 movies, people say. But volume 1 will be the 26th of November. Mm. Volume 2 will come out on Christmas Day. And then the finale, which is apparently like 2 hours, over 2 hours, will be on New Year's Eve.
Okay.
Which I think is like a nice big bold swing.
Yeah.
Mm.
I assume everyone's going to be at home.
Yeah, I was about to say. I mean, I've pretty much statistically been at home.
Yeah, exactly.
I'm not a like...
Oh, that's a good substitute for the Royal Variety program, because I always used to watch that, but now I don't have satellite television.
Yeah.
I always loved the Royal Variety show too.
It was so fun. It's such a good tradition.
Yeah.
Is that always on New Year's?
Yeah.
The day... Old
New Year's Eve.
New Year's Eve.
Okay.
Yeah.
Okay.
I don't know. Hopefully they kill off some of their main characters to give their story some stakes, because that last season was... Yeah, it was come on now. It's like they're always threatening a character to go die. Then they don't die. Yay.
Yeah. I mean, it's like Game of Thrones.
I know, but still. It's just like you have 25 main characters now.
Yeah.
And no one's like, Vecna's not a threat because he hasn't done any damage. So I'm like, okay, he killed some strangers. So what?
I'll never forget feeling like I discovered season one.
Oh, right.
Like it had no hype. It's hype built like halfway through.
Right.
And sort of near the end when everyone realized like how special season
one
was.
Right.
But I remember like starting and going like, this is fucking cool.
Mm.
like this is too good.
Yeah.
Like I really hope this doesn't fuck fucking ruin itself.
Right.
And then I was like, I really need to tell people about it. but I was like one and done. I didn't do the others.
Okay.
Oh, really?
Okay.
Yeah.
You didn't see Sean Astin? I think that was season 2 or 3.
No, I must say I was a bit like, I don't know whether I've got the emotional capacity to.
Oh no! But then you missed the Kate Bush episode. That was such a hype thing around season 4.
Oh, the running up the hill.
Yeah.
Okay.
Oh, that was a magnificent use of music in a film.
Yeah.
Sure.
Not gonna lie.
Sure. No, and I know the Metallica needle drop as well.
Yeah.
We've got that Funko out in the lobby.
Oh,
the
right.
Dude playing the guitar.
Oh yes, good old Joseph Quinn, who's now the
he's
Human
gonna,
Torch.
He's in a bunch of stuff.
Yeah, and he's going to play the guitar again as Harrison.
Okay.
Oh yes, is he Harrison?
He's going to be George Harrison in the Beatles biopics.
Nice. Right, right, right.
Yeah. And we see his genitals in Warfare.
You didn't say biopic.
No, it's biopic.
Okay, we
finally
settled. Oh my god, sorry, that was a thing that just happened. Over years I always just say biopic and never say anything.
Yeah, I know. No, and then I started saying biopic.
Yes.
I started saying both at the same time.
Yeah.
It's a biopic.
Okay.
I've surrendered to that. anyone else?
Cool.
More trailers.
Yeah, you can go.
The trailer to Guillermo del Toro's Frankenstein movie.
Yes.
Yes. I haven't seen it, but I know that there was something that they did at Netflix's Tudum.
Yes.
Oh, yeah. Tudum.
Yeah.
I always wanted
to... I think it's Tudum.
No. I always thought it was Tudum.
Yeah.
When you listened... I watched the first 5 minutes of it, not live, but it's now like something you can watch on Netflix.
Yeah.
She's like, welcome to Tudum. And I was like,
no, you're joking.
No, don't call it that.
What kind of South African suburban white accent is that?
They
Tudum.
They're recreating the noise. The
no, I know, but
noise.
It's Tudum. So like they put a Tudum. It's Tudum. That's what it is.
No, she called it Tudum. The main host.
That is awful.
But yeah, we brought that up a while ago.
Yes.
Tudum is Netflix's big convention, which happened over the weekend.
Yeah.
Where they've eventified this very thing that we're doing now, which is like announcing what's coming.
Yeah.
Mm. And I know they did something for Frankenstein. Mm.
Yeah, they brought out, is it Mia Goth that's in it?
Yeah.
Mia Goth, and Oscar Isaac, and Guillermo on stage.
Okay. Yeah, I really wish that film got a cinema release.
I'm hoping it is not getting a cinema release.
I'm not seeing it in the schedule.
Oh.
I'm privy to what's coming up, and it's not there.
There's a few other Netflix things have gotten, like Hitman is a hidden Netflix movie, but that got a limited release.
Yeah, because it's
Frankenstein. Come
it's
on,
it's also an Oscar-winning director and filmmaker producer.
Yeah.
Like, why is that not getting a cinematic release of like the most popular horror IP ever?
Yes,
like it doesn't make sense.
No, that's bizarre. Yeah.
And with Jacob Elordi, who's like the hottest shit in town.
Yeah.
Yeah. No, and, but I am excited about it, and I read Frankenstein for the first time ever in preparation for this movie.
So I love that you read so much to prepare for movies. You're so like such an eager reader, dude.
I'm trying.
It's so cool.
I've got I bought the Life of Chuck book.
Oh, cool.
Which I want to get to soon. But I'm finishing up Brave New World.
Okay.
The Aldous Huxley.
Yes. It's one of my favorite books, dude.
Okay, cool.
We'll chat more fucked up, it. But it's one of my favorite books.
Yeah. what were we talking about?
Frankenstein. Do we have opinions on the trailer?
I haven't seen it.
I mean, I haven't liked anything that guy's made since Pacific Rim.
Oh, right.
And it's always disappointed me to the point of very much disliking it.
Right.
So, especially Shape of Water, I was like, what the fuck is this?
Yeah.
I don't like the very romantic, naive, childlike framing of a story as a fairy tale thing. Don't tell me it's a story. Just tell me the story. Like, don't tell me it's not real. I want to believe it's real.
Yeah.
You know? So
I don't mind that. It's more the fact that I, you know, Shape of Water, it's got great actors and great production design and great visual effects, but I felt nothing.
Yeah.
That's my problem.
I find it weird when you have a movie like that that you just never come back to.
Yeah.
No part of you ever wants to sort of watch it again.
Mm.
It feels like it just disappeared.
Yeah.
Absolutely.
But it was like the hottest shit at the time.
Yeah.
It won the Oscars. It was everything. And then it just sort of disappears. It's funny how those movies do that.
Yeah. What did you think of his Pinocchio?
It was mid.
Yeah, I agree.
I mean, like, I think that story...
People were like losing their minds about that movie. Yeah.
I think the problem with Pinocchio is Pinocchio, but I think it's like really impossible to make Pinocchio good.
Yeah.
Because I think it's an inherently shit story. But like, yeah, it was unremarkable.
Yeah.
Like, looked beautiful.
Yes,
I think
exactly.
He's like a Tim Burton for me.
Yeah.
He's an art director.
Yeah.
And maybe a producer.
Mm.
You know?
Interesting.
Yeah. IMO. I mean, I did love Hellboy and Pan's Labyrinth, so there's that.
Yeah.
Yeah.
All right. Hey, did you guys see that Alex Garland is set to direct an Elden Ring movie?
What the fuck?
For A24.
What the fuck, dude?
And didn't we once say that he made an announcement that he was going to stop directing and then he just has just proceeded to make...
Like the most hardcore career move ever for a director like him.
Yeah.
What is this? What is Elden Ring?
Oh, Graham's, I think, best qualified to talk about it.
Oh, Lord. Elden Ring is a From Software video game. So the same guys who made, like, Dark Souls.
Remember you were watching me play Dark Souls when I lived with you, and you were like, you came into the room, like, after a couple of days of watching me, like, fight my way through Dark Souls and getting frustrated. It's like, Cole, isn't this a bit dark?
Isn't this a bit bad for you?
Yeah. It's like, I'm worried about you, friend. But yes, carry on.
Yeah, but it's hard to like explain the story because they don't really have stories, these games.
Mm-hmm.
They kind of, there's like a story going on in the background.
Like a very elusive lore.
But what's the world? Where are you?
No, lore.
Fantasy.
Yeah,
future.
Total fantasy.
It's like apocalyptic world, post-apocalyptic world, but
it's always
high fantasy.
It's always at the end of some realm's like lifespan and it's coming to an end and...
Okay.
You're either bringing it to an end or trying to revive it or something like that.
And who are you as a character?
You make your own character. It's an RPG, so you create your own character.
But you're probably like a chosen one that's going to save the world. I mean, in Elden Ring, you're trying to find
the
Elden
Ring. Tarnished.
Yeah. Also tarnished in Dying Souls. Dark Souls.
Okay.
In Dying Souls. In
they're
Dark
like
Souls.
Like
what
that
is
word,
the
apparently.
What is the Elden Ring?
We're asking the wrong questions about this.
Yeah, I know.
Like, it literally doesn't matter because the point of the game... is that it's very much a skills development based game where it's like the enemies are so hard, so it feels like a very old game in terms of it's got this escalated difficulty level. And like, I loved playing Dark Souls because it was about like facing these enemies over and over and over again and dying like 100 times.
Yeah.
But when you figure it out, when you figure out the rhythm of how they fight and stuff and you get the skill right, it's such an amazing high. It's such a cool sense of achievement. And like, you search Elden Ring online and all you'll see is these videos of guys struggling to defeat bosses or like defeating bosses quickly, and that's amazing and that kind of stuff.
Okay.
I don't know how you translate it into a movie. They're like, they can't take the video game and turn it into a movie because it doesn't have like a central character.
Mm-mm.
It doesn't really have a story. It's like at least 80 hours long, you know? So I'm not sure what exactly they're going to do with
this. The interesting thing about Elden Ring...
Yeah.
It being a From Software story is that it's got auteurs behind it, right?
Well, it was written in part, at least, by...
George R. R. Martin,
yes.
Mm.
The Game of Thrones guy.
Yes. So he did... I have no idea the extent of his involvement in it.
Isn't Hayao Miyazaki involved in Elden Ring?
No, there's another guy named Miyazaki.
Oh, sorry.
But it's not Hayao Miyazaki.
Okay.
The guy who created like Dark Souls and that sort of thing is also a Miyazaki.
Oh, okay. It's not... So it's like him coming back to like a Soulsborne game.
Yeah.
Right.
Something along those lines. But yeah, I don't know how they're going to turn it into a movie, but let's see.
Alex Garland's a cool guy with like interesting ideas.
Yeah.
Like his movies all have very interesting ideas.
But he's never really done this kind of high fantasy, has he?
No.
Also, A24 has never done a movie that is going to have to be this expensive.
Right.
Because it's like gigantic and fantasy. They're,
it's a production. It's an A24 production.
Yeah.
It's interesting seeing the stretching of what A24 means as it becomes more and more popular. It's so interesting to see a film distribution / production company almost be like a band where you're like, hey, it's this cool new band, like everyone fucking loves them, they're so like edgy and cool,
heard their new album,
they're the hot new thing, and then like before you see it they're like, okay, they're just like everyone else now.
Well, I know at some point, I don't remember if we spoke about this on the show, but they got an investment, they were invested by some massive investment company that like hugely elevated their like value essentially. So now they're incentivized to start making more profitable movies.
No, and of course there's nothing wrong with that. It's the same as being a cool band that then gets a really big record contract and you become really famous. Like, cool. Mm. Like, go out and make the best, coolest stuff ever.
Yeah.
It's just funny when you see that thing stretch.
Yeah.
Because that's what happens, when someone becomes popular, is they then appeal to more and more people.
Yeah. I think the question then becomes, like, what happens to A24's identity in terms of them being, like, the studio that takes risks and does all these big swings? Like, if their incentive is to now be a company that makes money, they can't really
do
that anymore.
Compromise?
I think Everything Everywhere All at Once was their first profitable movie.
Yeah.
Before that, they didn't actually make any money.
In 2 weeks' time, we are going to screen The Materialists.
Oh,
it's just called Materialists.
Yeah.
Which is the new Celine Song, which is exciting and cool. This is the woman who did Past Lives. But it's presented like a pretty well-packaged Sex in the City-esque romantic comedy.
Right.
So it's like, it looks, at least that's how it's being presented.
Yeah.
Okay.
It's very bright, colorful, all about falling in love in the big city.
Right.
Okay. But you know Celine Song's behind it, so you know...
What the fuck's going to break
my
heart?
It's going to have some 2025 nuance, and it's been sold like this is a modern-day romantic comedy.
Okay.
But it's a pretty straight-up film by the looks of things.
Interesting.
It'll be interesting to see how it's evolved and how it's more modern.
Yeah.
But it's still being presented as like quite a appetizing like hamburger. Do you know what I mean? Like not something too deconstructed and nuanced.
Yes.
Should we chat about other things? You got more?
I've got nothing more.
Okay.
Yeah, let's chat.
Let's talk about Venetian Scheme.
Oh, yes.
Where are you guys with Wes Anderson? Where are your thoughts and feelings? The last time we were together was when we watched Asteroid City, right?
Yeah, probably.
I fell asleep in that movie. Mm.
Yeah. I very much love Wes Anderson and very much feel like he was appealing to a very specific frequency that I got.
Right.
I came in at Life Aquatic and thought that was the greatest thing ever. The kookiness...
Been your favorite for a while.
Yeah, the kookiness appealed to me.
Right.
It's production design, its rhythm, its tone.
Mm.
I thought it had a lot of heart. At the core of that movie is, the story of a father and son. Only when I, many years later, screened it for my now wife, did I realize how weird it was. Where halfway through, she's like, this is weird.
Shame.
But Darjeeling Limited was great.
Yeah.
I started faltering a little at Moonrise Kingdom. I remember leaving that going, that didn't have much heart.
Okay.
Then Grand Budapest was good for me, but I was frustrated by the story of a story of a story.
Right.
French Dispatch to me was horseshit. I like left that going, this is the most pretentious bullshit I've ever seen.
Right.
Okay. Like it lacked everything for me. I don't know how you guys felt about French Dispatch. And then Asteroid City, to me, I thought it presented itself great, but once again was a radio play about a movie, about a story, right. And oh God. And I also left that cold.
It's like too many unprofound layers of meaning.
Yeah, and right. I think there's a really interesting conversation to have around when an artist finds such a specific niche for themselves, so much so that the internet makes AI versions of it,
yeah,
and it becomes a meme, and it becomes something that everybody copies. There's a book called Accidentally Wes Anderson, which is based on a very famous Instagram account of people in the world taking photographs of things that look like they come out of a Wes Anderson book.
Right.
I mean, yeah. A Wes Anderson movie. So you're now being so mocked, not mocked, but like celebrated,
parodied.
Copied, parodied, all versions of it. You then go, well, what do you do? Do you go, okay, well, fuck, I've now become I've now become so parodied. How do I move forward as an artist? Do I now have to find and redefine what Wes Anderson is and present a new Wes Anderson? Or do I double down and be the most Wes Anderson product there could be and continue to make authentic Wes Anderson in order to tell the parodiers
you can't do what I do.
Who the original is.
Yeah.
And I guess that's what he then chose to do. Like, I will double down and be the most Wes Anderson.
Yeah. I think a lot of people kind of misunderstand what the Wes Anderson style is. Like, they'll look at, oh, this is like symmetrical. That's Wes Anderson. But yeah. Wes Anderson's frames aren't symmetrical. They're orderly.
Yes.
It's not the same thing.
Yeah.
And I think Perrin has said this a few times of, oh, like, he's like an AI copy of himself.
Yeah.
But I disagree with that. I think you actually brought up Tim Burton recently. I think Tim Burton is someone who had this really distinct style, who kind of allowed that style to be co-opted and, like, filtered through the studio system. And it became, like, really just nothing. Like, Tim Burton kind of is not an interesting filmmaker anymore.
Yes.
I think Wes Anderson has kind of done the exact opposite of that. Like you're saying, he doubled down.
Yeah.
He hasn't become more sanitized. He's become like more Wes Anderson.
Yeah.
You know.
Exactly. And so here comes Phoenician Scheme.
Yeah.
Which premiered in Cannes. Yeah. And somewhat mixed reviews in the sense that I read something where someone was like, lacks heart. It's the same. It's just Wes Anderson.
Yes.
Other people saying good things. Visually stunning, and every frame is this painting. It's like, you either do love him or don't know of him.
Yeah,
I've always found it interesting that the economy behind him in the background is actually very small.
Okay,
his budgets are tiny.
Yeah.
The actors all famously get paid like the basest of salaries.
Union scale.
And this is like Tom Hanks, Scarlett Johansson, Benicio del Toro, like the most famous actors in the world want to be in his movies. Because I'd imagine at the end of the day, it's all just quite fun.
Yes.
And so Phoenician Scheme arrived. And I liked it.
Okay.
I appreciated the fact that some of those layers were now stripped.
Okay.
Someone must have told him, okay, just stop that shit. The whole like story of a play about a book about a movie.
Right.
It's the Phoenician Scheme is just a story.
Okay.
Which is great.
Speaking of which, what is it about? Let's start there.
Yes.
What's the back of the box?
Yeah, they were particularly vague about it in the beginning.
Yes.
But at the end of the day, it is all about Zsa Zsa Korda, who's played by Benicio del Toro, who is a international business magnate. Who is very wealthy,
right?
But has done quite corrupt things across his life. So he's got a lot of assassination attempts against him. And he wants to hand over his business and his empire to his daughter, who is played by Kate Winslet's daughter. I did not know that woman is Kate Winslet's daughter,
okay.
Who is now acting. But she's a nun. She wants to be a nun.
Right.
But at the end of the day, he is trying to complete his most ambitious project yet, which is a tunnel through Phoenicia, right. which is also highlighting the pretentiousness of Wes Anderson. Yes. This is Lebanon.
Right.
Modern-day Lebanon. And so we're not quite sure exactly what time period we're in.
Okay.
It might be... It's vague. It's funny. Okay. It's vague as to exactly when this movie is, yeah. is set. It could be more like 70s, 80s.
Okay.
And it's about the gap. It's all about the gap, which is this little this area of space between the tunnels where the tunnels now need to meet.
Right.
And he has to finance the literally the gap.
Okay.
Of this project. While people try and assassinate him, while he has to, yeah, I don't want to give too much away.
Okay.
But it involves Richard Ayoade as a terrorist. it's kooky. Michael Cera plays the sort of tutor.
Right.
But he does it so well. It's great. Cool. It's fun. It's a bit goofy. It feels goofier than the other ones.
Okay.
Like in Life Aquatic, there were goofy moments, but that was just Bill Murray being goofy, or
right.
Willem Dafoe like being a little bit goofy.
Yes.
This is a goofy movie.
Right.
Okay.
So like it is very clearly Wes Anderson, very clearly silly.
Yes.
To the point where perhaps there were a couple of moments where I wished in this beautifully stylized, blocked, beautiful scene, perhaps the actors could just have a little more authenticity.
Right.
A little more heart, so that it could feel just a little more real. Mm. But you don't quite get that. You get a very stylized play.
It's okay. Like they're mannequins in Wes Anderson films. Yeah,
and so perhaps you lose a little bit of empathy because it just feels so stylized.
Right.
But I left that experience going, no, this was much better than the others.
Okay.
It feels a little more of a dial back. And I left it with like, oh, there's kind of kooky memes in this.
Okay.
There's kooky phrases or set pieces or characters or moments that I think the world will remember.
Right.
So it won't be entirely lost. Where for me, I don't remember any part of Asteroid City.
Right.
Like yeah, maybe same. When that alien arrived because it looked slightly different. It was slightly stop motion or it was a bit more drawn, or I don't quite know how they did the alien.
Mm.
But this time it's like, I think the world will remember, like, have a complimentary hand grenade.
Right.
Because that comes up a few times where Benicio del Toro says, I myself feel very safe. Right. It's like these moments I think will like stick
catch
with us.
Yeah.
And Sarah's great.
Cool.
It's like he should have been in these movies 5 movies ago.
Right.
Because he tends to keep the same actors.
Yeah.
Which is very cool.
Yes.
So yeah, it's very much worth your time. I think you should see it on a big screen. And I'm not saying that just because we're screening it. Just because like these are beautiful frames. You feel the construction of the cinema better in cinema. Mm. And it's not as convoluted as previous ones.
Cool.
That's
it's
good.
A little bit more straight.
All right.
And it's a little more sillier. It's a little bit like in the doubling down, he's played a bit more to his strengths, which is like be silly.
Right.
So, yeah.
Cool.
Oh, yeah.
Oh, before we continue, it looks like Perrin's here.
Hey, guys. Sorry, I'm returning my copy of The Phoenician Scheme to you guys, the new Wes Anderson film. The boys wanted to watch it this weekend, but of course I snagged the last copy before we could close shop. So, yeah, I'm returning it so you guys can catch up on it. But, yeah, we've spoken extensively about Wes Anderson recently on the podcast and how he's not quite where we want him to be or where we prefer him to be as a filmmaker or as a storyteller. And he gets back on the right path for a brief moment in this one before he careens straight off of it, for me at least. My biggest issue with Wes Anderson lately, and anyone who knows me, I haven't been a fan of his last few films, namely French Dispatch. I wasn't a huge fan of Isle of Dogs, but I wasn't a big fan of French Dispatch, and I hated Asteroid City. Just because Wes Anderson feels like The style matters more than the substance these days. And I mean, people would argue with me that, you know, Asteroid City had a lot of substance. It's, you know, beneath the layers and layers of the play within a film, within a radio broadcast, within a this. And I don't know. I just feel like Wes Anderson is stuck in a style of a substance phase. Every Wes Anderson film feels like it's been generated by AI, being told to make a Wes Anderson film. And I just find nothing to latch onto in his new films. Stylistically, they look incredible, but it also feels like he's taking the piss now. It feels like an SNL sketch, you know what I mean? And the problem with the Phoenician Scheme is, like French Dispatch and like Asteroid City, I find myself bored most of the time. The plot I stopped caring about 30 minutes into the film. The characters are all bland and lifeless, and everyone plays the same type of role in every Wes Anderson film. And you can tell everyone's so excited to be in a Wes Anderson film, but everyone delivers the exact same manner in which to do it. There's no versatility. There's no variety in a Wes Anderson film in terms of performance. Everyone's cold and dull and deadpan and quirky, and it just gets tiresome so quickly. And that's what happened to the Phoenician Scheme for me, is it got very tiring very quickly. It has none of the heart and emotion that resonated so well in his earlier films, namely Royal Tenenbaums, Rushmore. Even Grand Budapest for me is his last great film. There's none of that anymore. Even the humor is like lacking. It's just played in the same manner every time, and I expect it. And it makes for very unsatisfying viewing experience, if you get what I'm saying. Sorry, I know you guys have to work. So here's my copy. Phoenician Scheme. It's Wes Anderson, so you'll either love it, you'll either hate it, or you'll either think it's bang average. He's back in form for brief moments, and then he's off form again, and he's missing his co-writer in Owen Wilson, who gave so much heart and soul to his best films, and we can see that that obviously was a factor. I want him to be back to his best, because I still really do enjoy Wes Anderson. Some of my favorite films of all time are his earlier works. But yeah, you might love it. Performances aside, even though I'm complaining about them, they are dependable. They are good. They are decent. Kate Winslet's daughter, who's the lead role in the movie opposite Benicio del Toro, is fantastic. But then again, these are performances you could have gotten any actor to do, because it's typically Wes Anderson. Anyways, enjoy. I will leave you now.
Thanks, bud. Cheers.
Let's talk about Karate Kid Legends.
Let's talk about Karate Kid Legends.
Oh, no.
It is delightful.
Yeah.
In a good way?
In a very fucking stupid way. For me, I obviously watched the original.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I think I saw the Hilary Swank one.
Okay. I remember, I saw the first two.
Yeah. Now, what is it? Fucking, it's almost as old as me.
Yeah.
The first Karate Kid came out before I was born.
Yeah, I think it was 84 or something like that.
83. Okay. Yeah, somewhere around there. So the movie is older than me.
Yeah, see.
So, yes. So it's well over 40. We are now in modern day New York, where a young Chinese a kid moves to New York with his mom, and within 5 minutes,
yes,
he sees a dojo and immediately finds himself put in to the crazy underground world of karate in New York.
Underground?
the karate scene.
Yes.
Okay, cool.
This is like in a city of however many million.
Yeah.
And immediately, falls in love with a girl who owns a pizza, works at a pizzeria around the corner, and her previous boyfriend is like really good at karate.
Yeah, but evil karate.
But like evil karate.
Yeah.
He's got like a sort of top knot ponytail.
Yeah.
Oh, what a villain.
Right. He's a great villain. And his mom's like, no more fighting.
Yeah.
Like, you're not allowed to do karate. Mm. His grandfather is Jackie Chan.
Yep.
Okay.
Who is like the head of a big fucking karate
his uncle,
school.
I think.
No, or his uncle.
Yeah. So it's unrelated to Jaden Smith, Karate Kid.
I think Jackie Chan's playing the same character.
Is he playing,
he's
the,
playing
same character?
The same character? Okay. There's no more Jaden Smith.
Yeah.
But,
okay.
But Jackie Chan is the instructor.
Oh, yeah. Yes, because it wasn't a remake per se, because he didn't play Mr. Miyagi in that one. Okay, cool.
Yeah.
Cool.
Yeah, you've got Miyagi over in Japan.
Yeah.
Mm.
And then you've got Jackie Chan in China.
Yeah.
Yes.
And your understanding is that Miyagi used the great combinations of karate and kung fu to sort of make his kind of special.
Yeah, like their
blend.
Families have like met in the past and they have history together.
Yeah. So Jackie Chan knows Miyagi. Miyagi once worked with Jackie Chan.
Okay. I remember that was a complaint about the Jackie Chan one previously, that he's doing kung fu, but it's a karate movie and those aren't the same thing.
Yeah. So this acknowledges
this addresses that.
That.
Okay, yeah. Cool.
And also what's interesting is that our main character is not a Caucasian.
Yeah.
Okay.
Which is what all the karate kids have been before.
Yes.
And you could question that perhaps in 2025 we are culturally appropriating.
Yes.
So the thing now is we've got this young Chinese kid who gives up his life in China to move to New York.
Yeah.
And as we said, immediately finds himself in this world. It's a little bit like all the people living in Miami that like aren't a part of the Fast and the Furious underground drag racing scene. It's like, what are you doing with your time if you are not deeply ingrained in this very niche subculture that seems to dominate the whole city?
Yeah,
amazing.
So immediately there is the request to do no fighting, but of course he has to fight to save the honor of his girlfriend and beat up the ugly
evil
karate kid. There is a tournament called the Five Boroughs.
Yes.
Which looks like something Red Bull would pay a lot of money for.
Yeah.
That would be like a sort of battle, like a street battle.
That they would then market as being like underground and no one knows about this, but we're spending millions of dollars on advertising.
Yeah. So he participates in this tournament. And of course he's like really talented because he like did do kung fu in China.
Okay.
But needs to like learn more to beat the bad guy. We also have Joshua Jackson, who we all know from Dawson's Creek and many other things, including Dr. Odyssey, which is...
you've spoken about that a few times.
Which is the great show on Disney Plus where he plays a doctor on a cruise ship.
Yes.
Which is a delightful show, by the way. I need to mention that is a big swing that very much... for me, paid off. It's a little bit of everything.
Right.
It's like Love Boat meets ER meets...
Jesus.
Everything.
How does Ralph Macchio fit into it?
So, he comes in near the end.
Oh.
Because...
he's not like his trainer.
He needs extra training to beat up the evil karate kid.
Because he needs someone to train him, because he's learned kung fu.
Okay, so
he needs
to
learn karate.
Okay.
So, Jackie Chan goes and recruits Ralph Macchio.
Yeah.
To come and train this kid.
And every time Ralph Macchio says the word karate, he says it in like a weird Japanese way.
Like karate.
Karate.
Yeah.
And it sounds silly.
I mean, it's probably correct, but it's a white guy saying it.
Yeah, it just feels weird. And then the movie culminates in the final epic battle, which is on the top of a New York building, like as the sun sets. On this kind of almost like helipad-looking platform, which must have cost so much fucking money.
Yeah.
You need the set piece.
No, and this is the thing, is that I love how even in 2025,
we
are building the stupid expectations of young boys to like be karate heroes because you think you're going to win on a rooftop in New York, where it would usually be some sweaty fucking little dojo where you get like orange slices and Oros.
Yeah.
Yes.
Like that's how every karate competition actually happens and actually takes place. And nobody knows about the Five Boroughs competition
unless you are like in the karate school. But of course, the whole of New York feels like they are there for this incredible moment.
Exactly.
Amazing.
And there's also like the big move he has to do, similar to how the iconic move in the first Karate Kid. So it's delightful. Yep. It's not made for 40-year-olds.
No. It's...
But if you take your kid, like, you'll watch it and be like, I'm pumped too.
Yeah.
Like, this is cool.
I think there's enough of, like, we were talking about this, there's enough of, like, the old man be like putting the whippersnapper in his place.
Yes.
And teaching them because they're, like, the old wise men.
Mm.
And, like, Ralph Macchio and Jackie Chan are fun together. Mm. I think the cast is good. I think the like, main lead dude, his name's Ben Wang, he's really good.
Yeah, he was a good actor.
He's really good, yeah.
He was in a Disney show with, I think it was a Hulu show or something, with Michelle Yeoh.
Okay.
About like a crime family. And he was like the black sheep of the family who wasn't like into crime and stuff.
Okay.
And it was cool, but it was cancelled after one season.
All right.
Yeah.
And he's good at all, I think he does most of the stunt stuff himself. He's really good at that stuff.
Oh, is it?
It's much more of like a Jackie Chan style kung fu movie than the other Karate Kid movies are. Those have like one fight at the end.
Do they have
a bunch of fight scenes throughout
it. Do they have his visual like kung fu comedy style?
A little bit. It's in there here and there.
Okay, cool.
There's like an early fight scene where he saves Joshua Jackson from getting beaten up, which is very Jackie Chan.
Yeah, that's sort of like using what's around you.
Yeah.
And that sort of look of like, I don't really know what I'm doing, but I'm highly competent.
Yeah. Yes, exactly.
Which Jackie Chan like perfected.
Yeah. Yeah. No, I'm sure everyone took great delight in like choreographing that.
Yeah.
So yeah, it lives up to all.
It's very sincere. It's very fun. It's sweet.
Something I want to just bring up. I want to remind you, because I have spoken about it more at length, but I also want to tell you, Cole, because I haven't had a chance.
Mm.
Life of Chuck starts this weekend.
Mm.
And I just want you to know that it exists. I'm talking to you, Cole, and I'm talking to everyone else who is browsing the shelves right now, overhearing us talking. People just need to know that this fucking movie exists.
Amazing.
Because it is, I really, really enjoyed it.
Cool.
It's based off a Stephen King short.
Yeah.
It's epic. It's bold. It's Graham, you love a big swing.
Yeah.
This is a huge swing.
Nice.
It's effectively the story of someone called Chuck, told in three parts. We start with part three and work backwards. But the first part is like the world is coming to an end.
Mm.
You know, the internet breaks.
Yeah.
The TV breaks down. Everything, we watch this world like slowly implode.
Mm.
Then it's also about his life growing up and love and what it means to be alive. Cole, it's amazing.
Sounds fucking cool.
It's a really, really special film.
I saw a clip that featured a street performer that's a really fucking incredible Instagram musician called The Pocket Queen.
Okay.
And she's busy playing drums and she's like narrating watching this guy walk towards her and she's like a fucking kick-ass drummer. And I was like, oh shit, she's in a movie.
Okay, that's cool that she is someone.
Yeah.
Okay.
She's not a rando.
So that's one of my favorite scenes in the movie, and I actually posted that on the Bioscope's Instagram as well. This little reel of this moment. It's narrated by Nick Offerman, who's got the coolest voice.
Yes.
And there's just this like self-enclosed little moment, which is in the movie, which kind of epitomizes the whole movie, which is like stopping your daily routine to just love and appreciate the moment. And how they do that is with Chuck, who's in some city for a conference, walking past this woman who's playing drums. And then it's all about the interaction between them where she sees him coming, so she changes her beat to him. And then when he's just about to walk past, he goes, fuck it. He puts down his briefcase and he starts dancing.
Right.
There's another woman who we also get the backstory of, who just gets this desire to go, you know what, fuck it, I'm going to dance with him too.
Okay.
And it's this beautiful dance sequence that's just two drums. There's no other music. It's just drumming. And she does it so well. And it's like, it's coordinated so well. And that's when my gooey like moment watching it like kicked in.
Right.
And that's when I was like, okay, this movie is special.
Okay.
It's just like, I would wish that to be an iconic scene in the world of cinema. Like, I would want that moment to join others
in, like, this is what makes cinema and movies incredible.
Right.
It's like the Jack Rabbit Slim's Dance from Pulp Fiction.
Totally.
That kind of vibe.
Totally. Like an iconic scene in cinema. Like, I would want this to join that.
Mm.
It deserves to be a part of it. Just because there's something about it that's just so enchanting.
Yeah.
So tickets are on sale. I really hope people just get the message. And so this is why I'm just trying to kind of advocate for it.
Cool.
But it's just amazing how some of these movies get lost and then they get discovered years later.
Right.
I've always felt that the really good ones will eventually find an audience.
Yes.
Hopefully it's
yes.
sooner rather than later.
Exactly. Right.
But this one is quite special. So okay. I just wanted to bring it up again.
Sure, there are a lot of movies to watch, and there are a lot of movies coming.
Yeah.
So I need to get on
it's
my
show. Yeah.
No, this is but this honestly, I don't know whether I'm just stuck in it, and that's what I've got is sometimes try and get more objective. But you know, I see these movies coming, I watch the trailers, I write the synopsis for the website. So I feel like everybody is aware of them. But then you realize, like, so often people just aren't.
We don't know.
Yeah.
Which is, we're in that world where if this isn't your bubble, you don't know about these things coming. But this is an amazing year for cinema.
Yeah.
Because as we said, we're getting a new Celine song in 2 weeks' time.
Yeah.
F1 is fucking marvelous.
Cool.
And I think it's going to be the biggest movie of the year.
Shit.
28 years later is soon.
Yeah.
That looks really fucking cool.
And then on top of that, we have Fantastic Four, Superman, Jurassic World.
Oh, I'm so excited about Superman.
Yeah, it's like there's like big movies coming.
July is like the big,
July
the big
is crazy,
blockbuster
actually.
Month. Because that'll be F1, Jurassic World, and Superman, and
Fantastic
Four. Then August is feeling more indie darling. Mm-hmm. So that's like in South Africa, we'll get the Bring Her Back, Raka Raka film, those dudes, which is going to be a fucking, apparently it's
very unpleasant.
Very unpleasant horror. But there's the new Darren Aronofsky.
Yes.
Then we get like Paul Thomas Anderson. There's a new Ari Aster. There's amazing cinema coming up this year. So it's like, it's very special.
Yeah.
That's awesome.
So I'm excited.
Mm.
Cole, what did you want to chat about? There's a nice TV show.
There is a nice TV show. It's on Amazon Prime, and it's called Overcompensating, and it's a co-production with A24.
Okay. So is this their first TV?
I have no idea.
Might be.
Interesting.
Okay.
And the instincts I got from watching the pilot is that it feels like the Not Another Cheerleader, Not Another Highest, what's teen movie, like noughties, 90s, high school comedy that we don't get anymore.
Okay.
You like that very innocence. Mm. It's about status. And
10 Things I Hate About You.
Yes. And it's just shamelessly a comedy, and it's not trying to be anything else. It's not trying to be. I don't think we've had that for a while.
Right.
Okay. Overcompensating.
Overcompensating on Netflix. And what it's about is it's about
Amazon.
Yes, Amazon Prime.
Yeah.
And it's produced by a guy named Benito Skinner, and he plays the lead character who is this prom king, like, football jock darling that goes to Yates University.
Okay.
Don't know if that's a fictional place. I think it is. And he is overcompensating because he's very closeted. Okay. And he meets other freshmen, and there's, of course, another boy involved. The, like, setup of the pilot was so fucking funny. I can't tell you. I was, like, laughing every 5 minutes at the show. And then it does such a good job of playing out this comedy in a way that feels novel.
Right.
And like the problem with like trying to be like an alpha male in front of the guys who think that alpha males are a real thing because they're part of a frat and everything.
Yes.
Like they're a bit insufferable. It gets a little bit annoying after like 7 episodes. You're like, fuck, these guys are howling like every episode. This is so annoying.
What does howling mean?
Like, oh.
Okay.
Because like, literally.
They're like, ooh, ooh, ooh. Yeah.
Yeah.
Like doing alpha male shit. I don't know what these guys do. But he finds another kindred spirit, and the whole like goal of the first episode is to get laid on your first night of college.
Right.
Otherwise, because you're either someone who fucks or you're someone that joins the improv group for the rest of college.
Right.
So, it's so funny. The improv guys are like, okay, we need a word. We need a word to start off, and someone shouts, queef. It's like, I'm Mr. Queef. It's so ridiculous. God. But highly recommended. Like, if you want to laugh, it felt like they didn't really resolve the first arc's problem.
Okay.
So that they could rather set up a second season, and right. they sacrificed that problem to like set up like a big cliffhanger at the end of season one.
Okay.
So I was like, fuck, okay, this is a bit, there was a tease, and I binge watched the whole thing with my friend Chris this weekend. Because we like love watching those kinds of movies together. Yeah. And it was, he like said to me, I was like, when is he going to kiss Miles? I want the boys to kiss. And then he said, no, watch, they're going to tease you until the end of the season. I was right. like, fuck you. Don't be right about this. I won't spoil it.
Do you think it's like a heterosexual person would dig it just as much?
Yeah.
Cool.
So it's absolutely. Not a, it's not a, it's not a, it's not a gay thing. Show per se.
No. No, it's not a gay thing.
Cool.
Okay. Sounds cool. Overcompensating.
Yeah. Overcompensating. Yes.
On Amazon.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Okay, magic.
The other thing that I discovered last night before I should have gone to bed, and I was like, I'm watching this, was Bono, Stories of Surrender.
Yes.
On Apple TV Plus.
Yeah. I've been listening to the Joe Rogan episode with him.
Okay.
Which is interesting.
It's a biography film. And he starts it off by saying, making a biography is the most navel-gazy thing you can do.
Right.
And then in very Bono fashion, he goes about it in the most navel-gazy way fucking possible. And I had a realization at the start of this episode, at the start of this thing, where I realized this is going to be such a good litmus test for like people, because people fucking hate Bono.
Yes.
Right? He's like the most divisive person in the world.
And love him. Yeah,
and love him. Like, he's like one of the greatest frontmen that's ever lived, always the most insufferable person alive.
Exactly.
They're like these polar opinions of him.
Yeah.
And it starts off and it's Bono doing spoken word poetry.
Yeah.
And someone's going to hear that and be like, fuck yeah, I'm into this.
Exactly.
Or someone's going to be like, no.
Yeah.
So what you get from the Rogan interview is he said in rehearsals, his wife, he's like, my missus. He just refers to his wife as his missus. He's like, my missus said, don't fucking do this. Like, don't do it. Like, cancel. Like, don't do it. And then when he did it for the first time, she was like, oh, I get it. Because what was missing was the audience. When he then performed it, it actually became more funny.
Right.
And when people were laughing with the stories and it was this conversation that then got a reaction, she's like, okay, I get it.
Okay.
Yes.
But he was like, this is the most pretentious thing I could do.
Yes.
Like, this is ridiculous.
See, that's what's cool about it is he kind of owns it.
He owns it. Right. Yeah, yeah.
And he's like shameless in it in a way that only Bono can be.
Yes.
Which makes you buy into it easier. Right.
Yeah.
But it is actually really fucking good. I like sends voice notes to the two theater directors I know, Brett and Daniel.
Nice.
And I said to them, what's happening here is a really interesting, like minimalist stripped down presentation of Bono's life where he's got like three chairs that represent the other members of U2. And he's talking to the chairs.
Yes.
And he like cues up all the songs and performs little snippets of a whole bunch of songs that makes the audience of U2 fans go crazy.
Yes.
So you get to vicariously enjoy the music that way if you're not a U2 fan.
Okay.
But then the lights, it's also about like the technicalities of theater.
Yeah, because it's effectively, it's him in a theater in LA.
I was about to ask, what's the format of this?
Yeah. The format is him on stage.
Okay.
Performing to an audience.
So it's almost
like a one-man show.
It's like a concert film of sorts.
Of sorts.
Yeah.
But it's very much like a one-man show.
Okay.
And they have this LED panel in the light in the background that like syncs up to the two musicians who are playing stripped-down versions of all the U2 songs.
Right.
And then he's also like in his late 60s, I think, mid to late 60s. And his voice has not changed. It is like still perfect.
Right.
And you're just like, you get absorbed in it and you can't help it. But what they do as well as in translating it to screen is they obviously like went in after they shot the live performance, but then in like typical like wide angle formats.
Right.
But then they went on stage with like a close up lens and shot close ups of him and cut it together fucking seamlessly.
Okay.
And it's like, it is an exceptional piece of filmmaking.
Right.
Yeah. And I just sat there at the end like, you can't deny Bono. You can't. Like, even if you hate him, this guy is so unique.
Right.
Yeah. I now need to watch it because I've only heard the conversation about it. Something else he reveals in the interview with Rogan, which I thought was interesting, is that he said in his moments of being the most vulnerable, he realizes like his default to cope with that is to be the most cocky.
Right.
And he uses this one example of when they had to perform in the Super Bowl and he like lost a feed in his ear.
Right.
And he's just like, you can just see this moment where like the chin comes out and he just gets fucking cocky. It's the same with Robbie Williams. You feel the same energy.
Right.
Where it's like to make up for being completely vulnerable.
Yeah.
And like so insecure, they mask it with this like absolute arrogance.
Mm.
And really, when you watch Better Man, you get that sense of Robbie Williams. And it's like the same with Bono. And so in those moments, like, you can see how some people are like, the cocky bastard. But yeah, it's interesting.
Cool.
So yeah, that is on Apple Plus.
Yes.
Apple TV Plus. Apple so it's TV free Plus. To watch if you subscribe Apple.
Yeah.
Okay, cool.
I know we've spoken about it, but also on Apple, I started watching The Studio.
Yeah.
It's same. So good.
Yeah.
It is so good.
It's
like,
fantastic.
I have a question though.
Yeah.
Is it like, because Jason Reitman did this with Saturday Nights.
Yeah.
The one about the first night of Saturday Night's broadcast.
Yeah, yeah.
Where if we have a thing, like a series or a film that's an uninterrupted one-er.
Yeah.
Do we just copy Birdman and do jazz drums? Is that like... Does everyone just do the same fucking thing?
Yeah.
Like, I feel like everyone's kind of forgotten about how derivative this is stylistically. Yes. It's like the exact same fucking thing.
Yeah.
And it's also about a production that's kind of going wrong, progressively like fucking up.
Jazz, exactly. Jazz signifies that, I guess.
So it's like, it's a studio, it's like Birdman, but in a studio.
Yeah.
It's like, so stylistically, it's not unique at all.
Yeah, there's just the one episode that's the one.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Oh, really? The opening?
Yeah, yeah. No, I think it's episode
the
2 or 3.
Second
is,
one,
the second one is the...
Yeah.
Is it's literally called The One-er.
Yeah.
Okay.
And it's done on purpose to be...
Because they're making a one-er in, yeah.
Yeah.
It's like whatever whatever they're doing with the episode like, is like reflected in whatever they're making in that episode.
Yeah. Yes.
You know, it's very clever. And it has... I have a very cynical view of Hollywood.
Sure.
And this like really shares that. It's like you can tell it's made by people who have like lived in that system and are very like jaded by it. And I so appreciate that.
The opening of we need to make a Kool-Aid Man movie.
Yes.
It's just like, what the fuck?
Yeah.
It's like insane. It's like what you were telling us when Barbie came out.
Yeah.
That they were making movies about.
Exactly. They started
Jenga
like,
and
developing.
Shit.
Mattel started. They have like 40 something. Properties, yes. And they were like, let's try and develop all of them as movies.
Absolutely insane.
Obviously, most of them won't, but the point is they were actually trying.
Yes.
Which is insane. It's And again, I've said this before, I'll say it again, Hollywood always learns the wrong lesson.
Yes.
Yeah, it wasn't that it was a toy. It was like what Barbie represents.
Exactly.
Yeah, sure. Okay, lovely. Thank you, guys.
Cool.
Appreciate you. It was a nice day.
Yeah.
It was a nice day at the office. Appreciate you guys.
Thank you.
We'll see you guys again next week.
Yeah.
The home base is thevideostore.co.za, and there's some lekker episodes with previous guests. Mentioned it before, a friend of mine, Bram, is going to come and visit us soon.
Oh, yes.
He's a war photographer, and
Damn.
There's a really cool chat that I know you guys will appreciate. That'll come up soon.
Cool.
Another thing I want to do, and I'm going to mention it now, is the fact that the Bioscope is turning 15 this year.
Woo!
This is our 15th anniversary, and in and around June is our kind of birthday month.
Cool.
The day we celebrate specifically is the 8th of June, which is coming up, which is this weekend.
Cool.
So what I want to do is sit down with you guys and a chat about the Bioscope. I want to do this one episode that kind of tells the story of the Bioscope as best I can in 40 minutes.
Yeah.
Cool.
To talk about some of the highlights and lessons I've learned and things like that, because I'm really getting my head into it.
Cool.
Thinking about it a lot. I've had to answer a few kind of press release questions and do interviews.
Mm.
And I thought a kind of verbal history of the Bioscope could be quite cool.
Cool.
Because I'm a bit better speaking than writing.
Yes.
I know this from years of doing Short Straw Press, where I'll always do the phoners and Al will always answer written stuff. Because he's better in writing. I'm better vocally.
Yes.
Funny how our brains work.
Yeah.
So I want to do that at some point.
That sounds fucking cool.
And put that out as well in June.
Nice.
Yeah, just for myself, really.
Cool.
And anyone.
I mean, it's your podcast and it's your cinema.
Yeah.
No, but just I think there's some interesting moments, and we've often lived without sort of head down another week, another month, another year. And so to like
pause for a second and go like, oh, that was really special.
Mm, right.
Or that was really cool. Or I'll forget, never forget doing that.
Yeah.
So yeah, we'll get to that.
Cool.
All right, Magic. Thank you, guys.
Yeah.
See you soon.
Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.
Farewell.